This is an edited version of the luncheon talks given at the RAOTC luncheon on the 24th of September 2009. These two speakers were requested at virtually zero notice to get up and talk when the main guest speaker for the day failed to arrive. The speakers are John Adcock, VK3ACA, and Drew Diamond, VK3XU. The topic is the 130 kHz low frequency band. We begin with John, VK3ACA, talking about the background to getting the band and a number of the current operating procedures. Over to you, John.
This is going to be a very ad-lib lecture. I haven't prepared anything. I suppose my interest went back to when I was a boy and I read in books that there were two areas of long-distance propagation or long-distance, two areas of the spectrum which were capable of worldwide radio propagation. One was the low-frequency end, the other was the high-frequency end. There's also a third area which is capable of long-distance propagation, that is below 7 Hz. There have been Europeans that have been experimenting with this, actually. I've seen a few comments on it, but exactly how they managed to get out on such a frequency, I don't know. The method of generating the signal is extremely difficult. I think it can be done below 50 Hz, but the Americans were transmitting on frequencies down there for some time, and there's not much... On a frequency like that, you have to have a very slow information rate. Anyway, as far as low frequency is concerned, a very long time ago, I think it might have been 30 years ago or more, I wrote to CQ and suggested that somebody should try and introduce a low frequency band. The editor published the letter that I wrote, and I've got no idea whether that started it all off. But the English got very interested in it. In America, they had a low-frequency area for the purpose of opening garage doors, that sort of thing. It was actually a CB band, and a lot of the Americans used this for communications. But it wasn't actually an amateur band, and they what power they could run was extremely limited. Following that, there was quite a long push about 20, 25 years ago or more. There was quite a strong push to try and get a low frequency band. And the English managed to procure this. Also, several of us in Australia managed to obtain experimental licenses. And I carried out some tests in transmitting using experimental license. I was heard in using plain Morse code. We were heard in Brisbane, New South Wales, South Australia. And at that time I approached John Bainbridge, and he has an enormously high antenna, and we decided to transmit from his place, and the signal was picked up in Perth and New Zealand. Now at the time we didn't run any more than 100 watts. But I'm not sure what the antenna radiated. It may have, in fact, been about 10% efficient. That was on 196 kilohertz. Now, the American low frequency band, the American CB allowed band where they allowed them to run signals for the purpose of domestic purposes anyway, that was roughly 150 to 180 kilohertz. Now the ZLs, rather cheekily, I think someone in New Zealand might have a strong influence in the government somehow. They managed to obtain an amateur band for that area from 150 to 170 kilohertz. They had to be extremely careful, though, that they didn't interfere with anything going on in the area. One thing that does go on those frequencies is pilot carriers, which are run on power lines for the purpose of protection pilot carriers on the power lines, and they said I'll have to watch what they did a fair bit. I was always of the opinion that we should push for a narrow band, basically because it's possible to slot it in somewhere. And this is what did happen in the end. It was pretty well decided that the band from 135.7, I think, to 137.8, I think, is the range of the present band. The English adopted that band, and they managed to get full amateur rights on it, or amateur rights with limited radiation. They managed to get that. When the authorities here were approached on the matter, they said they won't do anything about it until it's passed by the ITU. Well, eventually it was passed by the ITU only a year ago, so we now have a band. Personally, I think the band has come very much too late. It would have been much more interesting if it had happened 10 or 20 years ago. Quite a few countries in Europe have been using the band. Originally, everyone started off by using Morse code CW on the band, CW telegraphy on the band. But with weak signal detection, most long-distance contacts are done with weak signal methods, in particular ARGO and what they call QRSS. QRSS or EFCW, I think they call it. I'm not sure what that is. It might be a German abbreviation for narrowband frequency shift keying. They use frequency shift Morse code. What it consists of is that you have dots all the same length. You shift the frequency about 1 hertz, and 1 hertz is plenty when you're looking at a weak signal detection screen, because your lines end up too far apart if it's not much, if you get too much frequency shift. In fact, they come down a lot lower than that, like 0.2 of a hertz and that type of thing. When they're running, they run 10-second dots, 20-second dots, or even 100-second, 120-second dots. And the information rate, of course, is extremely low. The only way you can read this, there's no automatic reading method, the only way you can read this is to look at the ARGO screen and work out what the letters are from looking at the screen. It's quite impossible to read it by ear. That is the main method of transmitting information at the moment. Now, since the band became available, and that was only a few months ago, since it officially became available in Australia, I've only worked through so far on plain handset Morse, but there have been a couple of one-way recognitions. I've transmitted the signal. There's about three or four fellows up in New South Wales that are doing it, and they have the capability of reading weak signals, and the ZLs do, of course, they're very keen on the idea. Since then, I've copied the ZLs recently from their home QDHs, the ZL3JE. A few years ago, there was a lot more interest. The ZLs had a place called Quartz Hill, which is near Wellington. And I don't just suspect, they told me that they were running a lot more power than they were allowed to. In that period, they were trying to contact overseas, and I think they were heard all round the Pacific. How far they got, I'm not sure. They may have had a full contact. There's a lot of one-way communications going on without establishing a full contact. In not very long, I would say that I'd be capable of having a full two-way contact with New South Wales. But it's a bit academic, though, because it would be pre-arranged, probably not too terribly well. Now, just two nights ago, or Monday night, there's a Yahoo group for this. I made a note on the Yahoo group that I was going to run a transmission from 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock our time that night, and I did that, but it turned out to be a terrible night both ways. You get colossal static on those frequencies, and there were storms going on Monday night, and the reception was absolutely terrible. Well, that didn't worry me, I was transmitting, but it rained on the aerial, and the leakage on the aerial increased enormously, and I didn't get very far at all. the area of current dropped, and I had to raise the loading, and the loading went up, and where the power was going, I'm not sure. It might have been going into the wet halyard. Just mentioned the transmitter I'm using. I had a look on the internet to see if there were any kits for 136 kilohertz, and there was a transmitter kit for 136 kilohertz. It was put out by a fellow called G0NF. Yeah, something like that anyway. Anyway, I bought the kit and built it. The transmitter itself has a Class D final and it's capable of about 300 watts. Sorry, G0NFR. Anyway, MRF. No, I'm not sure. Anyway, forget that. I built the transmitter and I put DDS, Direct Digital Synthesizer, in it from Minikit. That works marvellously well. The transmitter works beautifully. I have the thought of improving the transmitter, actually. It could be improved a bit. But at the moment, I can't get more than 1.5 amps into the aerial without causing it to corona, so it's a bit limiting. The actual radiated power is probably ridiculously low. I've got no idea what it is. But anyway, we can get through to New South Wales from my place. We can get through to the fellows up in Sydney with a fair high degree of reliability, but we still haven't had a two-way QSO. The best part of my equipment is the transmitter. It works terrifically. Especially with the DDS, that came from Minikit in South Australia. I think some of you know the setup there. 5 EME, yeah, that's right. I told him I was going to do it, actually. I suggested to him that he could probably make a special DDS for low frequencies. The DDS can be made to frequency shift, and I've put a relay into frequency shifters. Anyway, that'll do.
Thank you, John. What an excellent off-the-cuff talk. Our next speaker is Drew Diamond, VK3XU, who will tell us how to get the license and follow it up with some helpful hints. Over to you, Drew.
To obtain permission to use the band, you'd simply apply for a license variation. Peter Young's not here, is he? Peter Young outlined this to us at the GIPS Tech, the special GIPS Tech function. It costs you $41 for a license variation, and then you can go on the air. The maximum permitted power that we may use is 1 watt radiated, John? 1 watt, ERP. It turns out that you probably have to run quite a few hundred watts to get that sort of power level. The efficiency of antennas is enormously low, probably less than 1% in a backyard. Nevertheless, our English friends, we've got quite a good body of material that we can draw on now. The RSGB handbook for the last two issues has had an LF chapter. The RSGB publishes an LF book, LF Today, I think it's called, which is available from the WIA bookshop by mail order. Quite a good book. If you're interested in getting into it, I'd suggest getting that book, LF Today. I don't know, it costs about $20 or $30, something like that. It's got circuits for receivers, transmitters, antennas, all the sorts of things you need to do to prepare to get on the band. It's a challenging band. It's not going to be easy. It's not like pressing a button on 2 metres or even putting up a dipole on 40 metres and working blokes interstate. And I think John illustrated that. It's going to be hard work from a suburban location. I'm a little bit privileged. I've got space, but I haven't got height. None of my trees are very tall, only about 40 feet. Nevertheless, I've been able to run out a wire out into the paddock, quite a long length, maybe 300 feet. And a downlead, which is only about 34 feet. Nevertheless, I'm much less current than John. I'm only running 50 watts, which gives me half an amp into the antenna. It's been heard by ear in Sale. A fellow rang me up one day and he said, I'm listening to you on a Pegelmess, something selective measuring set, German thing. He played it over the phone and it sounded pretty good, the little beacon that I've been running. I'll talk more about that in a minute. And it's been copied by the same crowd in New South Wales with the narrowband and DSP software and so on. I personally am not particularly interested in the narrowband slow speed modes. The only contacts I'm really interested in are ordinary Morse code contacts. In order that people might mess about with receivers and get ready for the band, I've been running a little beacon every weekend, or just about every weekend, from exactly lunchtime on Saturday to bedtime, and on Sunday from lunchtime to bedtime. So if you want to listen on 137.775, around the Melbourne area you'll hear it if your receiving setup is any good. I took a little portable set up out as far as Whittlesea a few weekends ago, and it was booming in out there. I was surprised, actually. I really didn't think I'd get out of Wonka Park. Before we had permission to use the band, I was running dots and things. I could hear it at Yarra Glen, and I thought, well, that's fair enough. It looks like it's working. If you're interested in getting onto it, if you've got an inverted L for 160 metres or an 80 metre dipole that has a down lead that comes straight down and it's got some height, you probably could press such an antenna into service. Your antenna is probably for suburban hams. It's going to be the limiting feature. So if you can get as much wire up in the air as high as possible with the old formula, the better. You can forget about transmitting on loops and helical antennas and that sort of thing. Just won't cut the mustard. The way things work at LF, you haven't got a resonant antenna. It's working far below resonance, which means you're just driving a capacitor. And you've got to resonate this capacitor with a loading coil. Subsequently, there's terrific voltages, as John was mentioning. You get all this corona. I haven't got corona at half an amp. I'm sure if I upped it a bit, I would. You can tell there's high voltage there, because if you hold fluorescent lamps near it, the thing lights up, and it's many thousands of volts, even at the low power level that I'm running. If you put a pencil on the top of the loading coil, you can draw a terrific arc. It looks very impressive. That's just wasted power. Most of it's probably wasted in the losses, ground losses, and resistive losses in the antenna. To receive, I think to think about receiving on the antenna is probably not a practical proposition, because most suburbs, most urban suburbs, would be just in a smog of electrical noise. It's very unfortunate. Switch mode power supplies have permeated everything. They're in everything. And these things have got harmonics. Some of them even operate at or near 137 kilohertz. So you're listening to the fundamental of somebody down the street, his computer, drifting in and out of your bandwidth. You've got to deal with all this. And the only way to do it, in my opinion, and I think John's come the same way, is to use a receiving loop. With a well-made, balanced receiving loop, on the law of averages, you can rotate this loop, even in the shack, even with a metal roof. Put it on a stool or something in the middle of the shack room, turn it around. You can often reduce this noise level down by maybe 20 or 30 dB if it's coming from your own household or around the... You pick the best spot, and it's odds on that you'll be able to hear the signal then that you're trying to hear. There is a loop in the pot line at AR. It's made from electrical conduit. It's a metre square. It's a balanced loop, which means its null is very deep and well-defined. All procurable components, and that should pop out in the next few months or so at AR, so do look out for that. It'd make a good project for somebody. I can supply bits and pieces of it, but not all of it, if you're stuck. And I think that's the thing, to have a listen on the band first, see what you can hear. Again, I disagree a little bit with John that the band has come too late. There are a lot of devices on the scene now that enable you to generate hundreds of watts in quite a small space, power MOSFETs. Most of the LF experimenters are using power MOSFETs in push-pull or push-pull parallel or Class E, Class D, and you're getting efficiencies like 90%. 90% of your DC input power is converted to radio frequency energy. And they're cool, they run cool, just like switch mode power supplies. To generate my frequency, I just start with a crystal. I had originally started with a VFO, but I think John rang me or posted me something one day and he said, "You're drifting." And the VFO just is not good enough for narrow bands. The warm-up drift particularly, you can see it on John's display. So I changed the VFO to a crystal, and I simply divide a 4.3 meg crystal, 4.3 something rather, down by 32. Comes out at 137.4 or points... Sorry, 137.375. I started at 137.4, it's now 137.375. Just divide it down, and it... Once it's warmed up, it just sits there. I have a counter on it, monitoring it, make sure it's on frequency and is stable. I've calculated my effective radiating power is 7 milliwatts. So, you know, that's the sort of power level that we're working at. There's scads of information out there. There's the books from the RSGB. There's also numerous websites. There's one called LF Experimenters, and it's also got 136 buried in the address, but... It's easy to find. You just Google 136 kilohertz LF or something in Google and boom, it's about the first thing that comes up. And there's scads of circuits, receiving circuits, transmitting circuits, antenna ideas and that sort of thing. So there's plenty of information out there because the Europeans, the Dutch particularly, are very keen, and the Germans and the English, They've been there for 10 years. They've got books on it and publications, so we just have to have a look at what they've been doing to find out. The noise level is terrific, as John mentioned. The static crashes are really loud, so that makes it even more challenging. There are moves afoot. Peter Young, I think, is probably the driving force, 3MV. He's trying to organise some sort of group activity on 500 and something kilohertz, around about there. If we ever get a band there, it would be just terrific. I was in England a year ago, and I had a little receiver with me. And I don't usually feel envy, but I felt envy when I was tuning around 502 kilohertz, and these blokes on CW having nice chin-wag, ordinary rag-tube conversations on that frequency. They've got full access to it, and of course the antenna requirements and so on are much more relaxed than they are on 136. So if you ever have the opportunity to do something about pushing for a band there, I think it would be well worth doing. It would be an interesting adventure for us. There's no commercial equipment, unless you can pick up an old ship's radio transmitter or something. Where have they all gone, by the way? There must be thousands of them out there somewhere. Scrapyard, melted down, come back as a Toyota or something. Anyway, an interesting band, and you probably would get out of your backyard on that band. I think that's about all I've got to say. Any questions?
The question was asked, what about earthing? Is it similar to the requirements for 160 metres?
Yes. Any of the chapters in your radio books about earthing. I haven't got earth at home, I've got stone, so I've had to use the bottom wire of a post and wire fence.
The question was, can you use a quarter wave radials on this band?
Yeah, not like Luke. No, ground is a problem at my place, but you just do what you can. But of course, the better the earth, the better it will be the signal. But it's not that, it's an interesting thing, because on 160 metres, say you've got a vertical, an inverted L antenna that's presenting 20 ohms at the feed point, resistive, so it's, say, 135 feet long. You've got this 20 ohms or 36 ohms, I think it should be. Even if your ground losses are 36 ohms, you're still going to get half your power into the antenna. But at 136 kilohertz, your radiation resistance is a fraction of an ohm, 0.05 of an ohm or something. So if your ground resistance is 30 ohms, most of your power is going to go up, just be wasted. So you've got to get that ground resistance down. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Drew, and thank you very much, John. And that concludes our talk for the luncheon today.